This is not your grandma's Bible study. Hello, and welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. I'm Jill.
And I'm Zach.
And today we are going to talk about this weird little ritual known as the Sota. It's found and described in Numbers 5, 11 through 31. And then we're going to compare it and spend most of our time with this other text. It's called the Proto-Evangelion of James, or the Proto-Gospel of James, sometimes just the Gospel of James. And it's a weird little, it's not really weird, we'll talk about it, but it's a story about the conception and birth of and childhood of Mary, the mother of Jesus. And it's doing some doctrinal heavy lifting, if you will. But there's a version of this Sota ritual that's found in that text. And so, we'll start with the Numbers text. And first I'll ask you, Zach, I know you're familiar with the story because it's kind of one of the fun texts for biblical scholars
right.
to look at because it is so weird. But do you have any history of, like, in churches or in other contexts of people knowing about this or referencing it or...
Yeah, I don't know if... I think the first time I ever heard about this was actually at my MDiv program. I don't think I ever heard this story prior to going to school. So I'm thinking, maybe. It's possible it was talked about, but I can guarantee you it was never preached on.
It was
never preached on.
Not real preaching.
And I guarantee it was never a Sunday school or anything other. I think it's probably MDiv was the first time I encountered it.
My master's program was probably the first time I had heard of it as well. Numbers just doesn't get a lot of play, which is unfortunate because I understand why it doesn't preach well. But it is a weird, magical little book.
It's got
so much crazy stuff going on in it.
It is.
And I think it's a fun book. So I'm going to start by reading briefly the passage, Numbers 5, 11 through 31. And then I'll give like a little bit of a non-biblical language breakdown of what's going on there, and then we'll discuss the proto-gospel.
Can you explain what Sota is to people? I'm not sure people might hear that, and
I don't know.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so you can.
In Hebrew,
I've never really thought about what this word means. I just know that's the name of the
Yeah, in Hebrew, Sota, no, actually, it means errant wife.
Well, that makes sense.
So that, just to kind of give a little bit of foreshadowing and a little bit of understanding of what Sota actually means, because I'm sure a lot of people are hearing Sota and being like, what's the Sota?
Yeah, so the ritual of the errant wife. Which makes some sense, although we'll deconstruct that a little bit. So the passage reads, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the Israelites and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, if a man has had intercourse with her, but it is hidden from her husband, so that she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, since she was not caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes on him, and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes on him, and he is jealous of his wife, though she has not defiled herself, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest, and he shall bring the offering required for her, one tenth of an ephah of barley flour. He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance." This is where it gets fun. "Then the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. The priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. The priest shall set the woman before the Lord, dishevel the woman's hair, and place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy. In his own hand the priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse. Then the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, if you have not turned aside to uncleanness while under your husband's authority, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings the curse. But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, if you have defiled yourself and some man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you an execration and an oath among your people, when the Lord makes your uterus drop, your womb discharge. Now may this water that brings the curse enter your bowels and make your womb discharge, your uterus drop, and the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. Then the priest shall put all these curses in writing and wash them off into the water of bitterness. He shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse, and the water that brings the curse shall enter her and cause bitter pain. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall elevate the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial portion and turn it into smoke on the altar, and afterwards shall make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain. And her womb shall discharge, her uterus drop, and the woman shall become an execration among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be immune and able to conceive children. This is the law in cases of jealousy, when a wife, while under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes on a man and he is jealous of his wife, then he shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall apply this entire law to her. The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity.
Ooh.
So, man, ancient rule writing, they're wordy. Also,
and thorough.
And thorough and very repetitive. Okay, so I first off want to just note that this ritual, it's really complex and it's incredibly dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. It is very much intended to shame the woman, regardless of whether she actually, even in that society, merits the shame. So the justification, and this is what I think is really important, for the use of this ritual is mere suspicion of infidelity on the husband's part. There doesn't have to be any proof. There doesn't have to be any evidence. She could just be really unfortunate and married to a suspicious guy. But as long as he's jealous, there's sufficient cause to bring his wife before the priest for judgment, which, you know, I find problematic.
Well, yeah.
But I also have very, you know, 21st century views of relationships and love and marriage and blah, blah, blah. So, I think it's also important to note that all throughout this text, it keeps talking about while under her husband's authority.
And right.
It's important to recognize that though there might be examples of loving, caring, mutual, you know, mutually affectionate partnership style marriages in the ancient world, that's not why people got married.
Nope.
They were business contracts. It was a property exchange. So to be under her husband's authority is, she is subjected to this because she doesn't have any rights of her own, for the most part. Again, there are lots of exceptions to the rule, but in general, the way women are talked about is that they are property and objects. So as long as he's jealous, he can bring her to the priest for judgment. When he brings his wife to the priest, he also must bring a grain offering of jealousy for her. Which we're not going to talk about the grain offering.
No.
That's, we'll save that for another less interesting day. the priest then, he takes the woman and stands her before the Lord, whatever that means. And then the priest makes a concoction of water and dirt from the sanctuary floor. So it's important to remember at this point, they're still in the wilderness. This is not a temple. It's a traveling sanctuary. So, like, it's literally water and dirt. Mm-hmm. It's not even like sacred dust from the temple.
Ooh.
It's literally just like the dirt
just
that
dirt they're standing on.
They're standing on and animals have peed on. And, you know, I'm just trying to paint a picture here.
It's probably why it's bitter.
It's probably why it's bitter. So after he mixes this concoction up, the priest is supposed to mess up the woman's hair and then place her hands in the grain offering of jealousy. The messing of the hair is kind of a shameful, like it's a thing to shame her. I don't really understand what the placing of her hands in the sacrifice or in the offering has to do other than to perhaps, like, unless there's some sort of, like, magical, an understanding of some sort of something magical happening in her touching that offering. Which, in the Book of Numbers, like I said, it's a weird little magical book. There's
it
a
is.
Lot of what we would consider magic to be happening in this book. So then the priest must utter this oath, but it's more like an incantation, I think, than an oath, that clarifies the consequences of drinking the potion. So if she's been faithful, she'll be immune. And if she's been unfaithful, her uterus will drop out and her womb will discharge. Sounds so pleasant. But also, I mean, it's one of those things to just indicate that, like, the whole purpose of this, in a sense, is to force an abortion.
Yeah, pretty much.
If she's pregnant.
Yep.
So take that for what you will. It's really, it is what it is. It is what it was. So she also has to take some form of the oath of the curse, but what she has to say isn't really spelled out. Much more concerned with what the priest's incantation is. And then she has to agree with the priest's oath or incantation by saying, "Amen, amen, so let it be."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So after reciting the oath, the priest is supposed to write out what he said and then wash the words into the potion.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, that's a, I've read something somewhere before that talks about how, because so few people could write,
mm-hmm.
That there are lots of links between, you know, the writing of this is, and the kind of a consumption of the words of the oath. It's a magical act.
Yep.
It's,
mm-hmm.
The idea of writing having like weird power was, I don't think, out of the realm of possible, mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. what they were understanding to be at the time. Cause just nobody, you know, the priest is probably one of five people in this whole, maybe five people. So after all of this, the priest then makes the woman drink the water, burn a portion of the grain offering of jealousy. So the woman drinks the water, and then the priest burns a portion of the grain offering of jealousy on the altar, and then he has her drink the water again. And then the priest, and presumably the husband, although he has not been active since bringing her to the priest, he doesn't have any role in this other than deliver the woman that he doesn't trust, brings her to the priest, and then he waits to see how the waters will affect
mm-hmm.
her. And so my assumption is that they think it's going to be pretty immediate effect.
Yeah, this isn't like a long...
Yeah, it's not like if she just happens to miscarry the baby...
Come back in a week or something.
You know, a month later, they're like, oh, that's just proof. I mean, I think it was kind of an immediate thing, so...
Mm-hmm.
So that's the ritual of the errant wife.
Which is very strange.
I think it's Claudia Kamp maybe who refers to it as the ritual of the jealous husband.
Yes, which is really what it should be called.
Yeah, because I mean, it's all about jealousy because there is no evidence. So anyway, that's what's going on in Numbers. And then we've got a version of this story that happens in the proto-gospel of James, in chapters 15 and 16. So I'm going to start with just like a little bit of a summary of the proto-gospel, and then we'll come back and we'll compare what's happening in the proto-gospel with what we saw in Numbers. So the proto-gospel of James, it's 24 chapters. It's a pretty short document though, and it's sort of pretty evenly divides into 8, 8, and 8. So the first part, chapters 1 through 8, is more concerned with Mary's conception and her birth. I said that weird, so it kind of sounds like... So the conception literally of Mary, not her conceiving a child.
Right. Yeah.
Conception, okay. So her parents in the text are Joachim and Anna. And it starts out with both of them being very sad that they can't have children. And they both individually, bring up Abraham and Sarah and the trope of having a child in old age. But Joachim's he decides he's going to go to the wilderness and fast for 40 days, until God answers him. And Anna thinks that her husband has died, so she assumes, A, she's a widow, but also she's not had children.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's very distraught. And then she gets promised by an angel that she's going to have a child. And her immediate response is, okay, well, then I promise to give it back to the Lord as an offering. So it's very Hannah, like mm-hmm. we discussed in one of the other podcast episodes, that... You know, you pray and pray and pray for this child, and then you immediately give it up as soon as you have it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Joachim comes home, and Anna realizes that she's not a widow. She's not only has she received a promise to have a child, but she's also got her husband back. And she's also already pregnant when he gets back. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear in the text that it is a non-sexual conception of Mary. So Anna is not described as being a virgin, but Mary is a miracle child. Mm. Because there was no social intercourse involved, say like a grown up. That's part of that is in an attempt to sort of, you know, how can Mary be the mother of the Lord? Mm-hmm. She's just a common person. So it's, some of this is really working to understand who Mary was and really defend her purity in a lot of ways. I should note that this gospel is probably written in the late 2nd century.
Okay.
So it's early Christian, but it's post, I think, all of the New Testament writings. Yeah, there are some that fall into the early 2nd century. But a big question was really how to make sense of Mary's role. How are we to understand her since she's the mother of Christ? So she's born out of a non-sexual situation. And at 6 months old, Anna decides to see how Mary can handle it if she puts her on the ground, and Mary walks 7 steps at 6 months.
Nice.
And then Anna's like, you'll never touch the ground again until you touch the ground of the temple or whatever. So she makes, and I think what she means is like, you won't ever touch common ground again or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Because she ends up making Mary's bedroom into like a sanctuary, and nothing common was allowed in.
Uh-huh.
So they really set her up to being raised in like a ritual purity level of the temple. Only the pure maidens were allowed to come and play with her.
Only the pure ones.
And so at 3 years old, she is given to the temple to be in their care. It says that she was fed like a dove and received food from the hand of an angel.
Hmm.
So it's very like ancient Disney princess kind of feel with how they describe her in the temple. And when she's 12 years old, the priests decide they've got to get her out of the temple because she botched her period. And can't have that nonsense in here.
Can't have that.
So they have to figure out what are they going to do with her. She's been appointed to their care, but she can't stay in the temple any longer because she'll defile it. And so they're like, well, let's cast lots and decide who's, like, bring all the widowers from town and we'll cast lots and see who gets her. Joseph gets her. He's divinely selected, if you will.
Of course.
To serve as her husband. But because of the age difference, he kind of protests this, and they kind of make it, I don't remember if it's explicitly stated. I just read it again yesterday and I should have taken note, but it doesn't. Joseph seems very wary that he doesn't want a young wife like this. He's too old for this. Just very lethal weapon. Get him too old for this. But he agrees to marry her anyway because the priests make her. So that moves us into the second part, chapters 9 through 16. So Joseph marries Mary. But then he like immediately is like, I'm a carpenter. Carpenter's got a carpent. So I'm going to go and build some houses. And presumably he's away for like 3.5 years. The way that the text kind of makes it seem is like they get married and, well, they get betrothed. They're not even married.
Right.
He's out the door. And so while he's away, she gets pregnant. And she forgets, like, what the angel told her. Like, she's just like, I'm pregnant. I don't remember why.
I totally forgot that the angel told me something.
Yeah, totally forgot that this was why. And so when he comes back, and during this time, you get a bit of the familiar story of her going to visit Elizabeth, John the Baptist. And so when Joseph gets back and, like, realizes, like, she knocked up, he makes it about himself. And he's like, I didn't guard her virginity. I failed her. Her husband. And she's like, no, I didn't have sex with a man, but I don't know how this happened, kind of thing. And Joseph seems to believe her.
Interesting.
Which I think is also true in Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Or Matthew. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. It's another day. I think it's Matthew because he wants to put her away secretly, but
yeah,
decides not to.
That's probably right.
So he was a believer, but then an angel comes and confirms to Joseph, like, you're not crazy. You really did. She really is knocked up because of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then immediately after that, the priests find out. And then that's where the Sotar ritual comes in. So we'll come back to that in just a minute to determine if they've been honorable or not honorable. And the third part is has a lot of familiarity with the canonical gospel nativities, but it's got some new stuff in it. So they do have to go to Bethlehem for the census, but she delivers in a cave, not a stable.
Mm.
And it's a miraculous delivery. She's alone because Joseph goes out to try to find a Hebrew midwife that can come and help deliver the baby. He finds one, but as they're coming back, they see a bright light in the cave. And when they arrive in the cave, she's already delivered the baby.
Wow.
And he's breastfeeding and he's happy and quiet and not like a newborn infant at all, I think. So this woman, her name is Salome. She is the midwife. She goes to find her friend whose name is Salome. She's a friend of this midwife, and who turns out to be just totally unnecessary. There's a lot of unnecessary components to this. The midwife goes to Salome and is like, oh my gosh, you're never going to believe this miraculous delivery. And Salome is like, I don't believe it. And she wants some proof. So this is what I was talking about in one of our previous episodes. She goes in and she does the insertion test, if you will, to basically, I think, to inspect if the hymen is intact or not.
Right.
And what her hand becomes inflamed, like it's apparently on fire.
Wow.
That's a new one. But then an angel appears and is like, you know, this can be healed if you like reach out to the child and pray, reach out to the child and lift the child up. So by praying and lifting the child up, her hand is healed. So it's got some Thomas parallels.
Yeah.
You know, I won't believe it until I touch, except with Thomas, as soon as he sees the risen Christ, he believes.
Right.
He doesn't actually have to touch the wounds.
Doesn't get set on fire.
He doesn't get set on fire. But then whenever... This is where it gets so funny to me. Whenever they find out that they hear that Herod wants all of the children 2 years and younger to be killed because he has heard that there's a new king that's going to combat him or whatever. For Elizabeth, because I think this is one of the interesting things that the text does. Nobody thinks about like, oh, is John the Baptist also in trouble? Because according to the narrative, they're like 6 months apart or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth goes and prays and hides. She wants to flee to the mountains, but she knows she can't climb the mountain with the baby. So
right.
She prays, the mountain opens, and she's able to go into the mountain, and the mountain closes and protects her and John from Herod. Meanwhile, Zechariah is killed because they go and they're like, where's your son? He's like, his response is literally, well, what it means literally is, I've been at work all day. How am I supposed to know where my kid is?
I don't know.
That's basically what he says.
So they kill him.
They kill him. But Mary, when she finds out, she just hides Jesus among cows. She just puts him in a cow stable.
Wow.
I guess Herod's
got some lazy inspectors.
I know. I read that and I was like, that is so funny. And literally... that is the last thing that is said about Jesus in this gospel. You get 29 more verses about how the priests deal with Zechariah's murder.
Wow.
In justice and in replacing him. Like, and that's how it ends, is on like Zechariah was murdered. So
wow.
I just think it's funny. It's like this mountain opens up and protects John the Baptist. Jesus goes and hangs out with some cows. And now we're going to talk only about Zechariah and his murder. So I just think that last little bit, whoever wrote this or put it together, they really like derailed at the very end. They really lost sight of what was supposed to be going on here. So anyway, that is the Proto-Gospel of James in a nutshell. And I just can't believe he was with cows. That's just so funny to me. So now let's just talk a little bit about how the ritual gets played out in Proto-Gospel of James. So Mary's chastity in this gospel is continually called into question,
sure.
As you might imagine. So chapters 11 through 14, like I said, they reflect some of the familiar Lucan nativity story, but there are some variations. But in chapter 15, Annas, the scribe, discovers that Mary is pregnant when he goes to find out why Joseph has not been present at council. Because Joseph had received Mary from the temple, this was particularly scandalous. She was supposed to be protected and guarded. She wasn't just his wife to have. So when they get there, you know, they discover that she's pregnant. I mentioned this earlier, reflecting that, you know, the patriarchal structures of that society, Joseph's response was, "Who has preyed upon me?" Like, bro, she's not your body. Like, you know, Annas goes to find out what's going on with her, with Joseph, finds out that she's pregnant. And so he and all of the priests also assume that Mary has been sexually active like Joseph did. So the first high priest questions Mary, saying, "Why have you done this? Why have you humiliated your soul and forgotten the Lord your God?" Mary responds with tears, saying that she's pure. It appears as though the priest does not believe her. So the priest questions Joseph. "Why have you done this?" he asks Joseph. And Joseph tells the priest that he has been pure towards her. And the priest again does not believe. So he calls on the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, those who don't know Decalogue, to reinforce his authority. And he says, "Do not bear false witness, but speak the truth." Joseph and apparently Mary also remain silent at this at the statement. Like, we've already said our piece, so you hush. I should just imagine a lot of sass happening, but I know it wasn't. Be much more of it, fun if it was. They were busy plotting out where to put which cow stable was going to be the best to raise their child in. So at this point, the priest decides that he will have both Mary and Joseph drink, quote, the water of refutation. It's not, as we'll see, it's not a clear-cut, straight-on comparison or following of the ritual, I guess.
Yeah.
There are lots of deviations, but it seems to really be influenced by the Sotar ritual. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of interesting changes. First, in this scene, it's the priest, not the husband, whose suspicion justifies the practice of the ritual. But this might not be as big of a leap as it first seems, technically, since Mary is to remain a virgin because she has been dedicated to the Lord. The high priest might be considered not only a mediator between the people and God, but a representative of God. And if this is the case, then his suspicion could be on behalf of God, might be understood in the situation as being Mary's husband. So that could be some of the justification for that. So we've got in the Numbers narrative, the husband's role is essentially finished with this accusation.
Yeah.
So while there aren't any recorded instances in the Hebrew Bible of this ritual actually being practiced, and I'm not certain, even outside of it, besides this particular text, I'm not certain that there's any evidence that it was practiced anywhere else. I'd have to do a little bit more research on that, but there's just definitely nothing in the canonical scriptures,
correct,
about this actually ever having happened to somebody. But if it were practiced, say, it just doesn't get, you know, the how the ritual is supposed to go down gets recorded and that's enough. There's no other reason to tell the story because it doesn't come up in anything worth remembering. Sorry, I lost my spot here. So if it were practiced, then one might expect... because of the role of the priest in Numbers is so prominent that the role of the husband could be totally displaced by the priest. So that's maybe something that if it was ever practiced in real life, that sort of gets replaced. A second interesting feature, I think, is that the priest gives the potion to Joseph as well as to Mary. The proto-gospel, it doesn't record any type of oath or incantation by the priest, like we have at length in Numbers 5. So either this incantation in practice was not that important, or there was an incantation for a husband that is assumed by the author. But because the Sotah is so ritualistic, with a procedure outlined in Numbers, it seems to me that the incantation would be a very important part mm-hmm, of it.
Mm-hmm.
In that way, the sota, like I said, it reflects a magic ritual. And by that I mean, like, the use of a means, like a charm or a spell, believed to have supernatural power over natural forces. So in cases like this, the steps are really, really important. Thus, the fact that in numbers the ritual requires an oath or an incantation being spoken and written leads me to believe that either the text is assuming an incantation or that it is alluding to the power of the ritual without any attempt to really follow its prescriptions, which is entirely possible as well. So a third interesting feature, so the first is that the priest, not the husband, is the one that's suspicious. Mm-hmm. The second is that Joseph is forced to drink as well as Mary, and that there's no incantation. But the third is that Joseph is given the drink first. So this causes me to wonder whose sin, if you will, is greater in the eyes of the priest. Is it Mary's? She was dedicated to the Lord at a young age and has the tangible indication of sin in her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using sin in quotations here. In fact, the priest questions her chastity before he questions Joseph's integrity. But it could be Joseph's. That's more more damning in the eyes of the priest. Because as he's an older man, perhaps he's expected to exercise self-control.
Mm-hmm.
So is the priest more concerned with Joseph bearing false witness than he is with Mary's unchastity? So while the priest questions Mary first, he tests Joseph first. And I'm really interested in, is this because Joseph's indiscretion will bring shame on the council, and Mary's will only bring shame on herself and maybe her immediate family?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, is there more at stake with Joseph being a sinner here than with Mary in a larger sort of patriarchal structure here? So, and then a fourth interesting feature is that Joseph and Mary are both sent out into the wilderness separately after they drink the potion.
Hmm.
So the ritual in Numbers, it doesn't prescribe the exile into the wilderness. But the narrative time of the prescription in Numbers is during the wilderness wanderings.
Hmm.
So if you notice in 517, the priest, like I mentioned earlier, takes dust from the floor of the tabernacle, not a temple. So perhaps this is an attempt at following the prescriptions of the sota.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be rooted in an understanding of God revealing God's self in the wilderness. Think of Hagar, the Israelites after the Exodus, Jesus during his fast. So the wilderness is often a place of revelation.
Right.
And I also think earlier in this, Joachim, I think that's where he goes for 40 days to fast, is not just a way he goes into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, their exile into the wilderness after the drinking potion, I think it's just a really interesting addition to this ritual. And at the end of this section, the people, apparently this was a really publicized event. They had good marketing. they were amazed that Mary and Joseph were found innocent, which I kind of just want to be like, having people drink dirt water isn't...
a spectacle?
It's not a spectacle. It's also not an effective way to determine if somebody's...
Let's see if they're guilty or not.
Guilty or not.
Drink the dirt water.
Yeah. Like, what if we did that in court today? That's the new The Glove.
Please step forward and drink this dirt water.
Or whatever it is. The Glove fits whatever it was. I didn't watch that. Anyway, they should have just had OJ drink dirt water, and that would have clarified so many things.
His uterus would have dropped, and
his uterus would have dropped, his womb would have discharged,
and then we would have known.
So anyway, so this is really publicized apparently, and the priest then recognizes their innocence. The priest is like, doesn't question, like, maybe dirt water is not the most effective way to determine if somebody has been, you know, unchaste. So the priest recognizes their innocence and he lets them go free. And then Mary and Joseph, they return to their home. And then after that, we roll into the next section that we talked about earlier with, you know, the familiar Lucan stuff of an order out from the king, go to Jerusalem. So just to kind of wrap this up, some concluding thoughts that I have, and then I'll let you chime in if you've got anything that you want to add. So I think there are a couple of power dynamics at play here, and I really want to forefront them. First, there's some disregard for the prescriptions of the ritual in Numbers 5. Some places, it's possible that the author is assuming the reader will know the details in the recitation of the incantation, perhaps. But this can't be known for certain. In part because it's hard to know if this ritual was practiced in any meaningful way, or if the author of this gospel just kind of had that ritual shaken around in his head and thought, oh, this would be an interesting thing to say happened or whatever. Or if there was a ritual that was happening and it just changed over time. Mm-hmm. So in other places, it appears as though the author is rewriting the ritual. The priest, rather than the husband, accuses Joseph must drink the potion, the wilderness exile. So this indicates that the author of the text felt comfortable reworking the ritual to suit the purposes of his narrative, or he was working, like I mentioned, with a common practice of the ritual that deviated from the Numbers text, and that the Numbers text didn't hold any authoritative weight for this author, at least not in the same way that we might understand authority of scripture today.
Mm-hmm.
The text also clearly privileges men. Mary's chastity is undoubtedly questioned, but it is the men in the story who determine her fate. Joseph's decision to divorce her, the priest's decision to test her, the masculine God's decision to clear her of wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mary is little more than a vessel for the impending child, and the whole narrative is working to demonstrate her purity and to therefore justify her as bearing the child of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's not defending Mary's integrity for her own sake. And then finally, though Mary's integrity is maintained throughout the narrative, it's a really passive integrity. She's gifted to the temple by her parents, not by her own will. She was gifted to Joseph by the priests, not by her own decision.
Mm-hmm.
She's impregnated by the Holy Spirit, not by her own will. She is accused of and tried for adultery and infidelity by the suspicion of priests, not by her own actions. And she's continually acting in accord with another's plan for her life. And this ritual is just one particularly dehumanizing aspect of her lack of agency.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a weird little ritual. I'm really grateful it's not something that gets practiced today. I'm grateful... I'm grateful in some ways that this text didn't become canon because it's bizarre. But I do like it, and I think it's worth reading because it really is struggling with the question of, so why is Mary so special?
Mm-hmm.
And also making sure that people are very clear, like, so she was a virgin when she conceived that baby, and she was a virgin after she delivered.
Right, right.
Because the construct of virginity wasn't actually about sexual intercourse.
Right.
It had to do with the breaking of the hymen, right, which would mean that if she had a vaginal delivery,
right,
the baby would break the hymen and she wouldn't be a virgin anymore,
right,
because she delivered a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just it's a weird little ritual,
mm-hmm,
weird gospel that's kind of fun. Just remember that Jesus is hiding among the cows, so always treat cows with respect. It might be Jesus in disguise.
he might be there.
So, you have any final thoughts or anything you want to add? Or
yeah. So I was looking up some stuff while you were reading the Proto James account, and there's a little bit of a parallel actually in the Mishnah with the soda ritual.
Oh.
So it's way more expanded there. There's a lot of stuff written there about it. But the one thing that's interesting is the very first part of it. And it's in Nashim, if you want to look it up. It's the fifth tractate in the Mishnah in the order of Nashim. In chapter one, it talks about how the husband has to manifest his jealousy. I guess there's a specific way that the husband has to show that he's jealous. But then also how the Sanhedrin urges the woman to admit her guilt rather than undergo the ordeal. And that was a little similar to how the high priest is coming out. And so it's kind of a council, sort of an already awareness of what's going on versus just a single priest, the man, the woman, and the priest. There's a whole committee involved in this process in the Mishnah. So that's the one thing that stuck out to me. I was like, that's interesting.
Sure, my dissertation on versions of the Sota ritual.
There you go.
Maybe my next book.
The only other thing that I think stuck out to me, just again in the emphasizing the patriarchy of the Old Testament Hebrew Bible and just the Bible in general, is that there's a similar instance of a man being suspicious about his woman, so to speak, in Deuteronomy, and it's in 22 about premarital sex happening. So in a similar way, but different in Numbers 5, because if he's wrong, nothing happens to him. He's fine. He's innocent, even if he was jealous, because of the ways in which she was apparently acting and the ways that she was behaving. So, but in Deuteronomy, he gets fined if he is. So, so in, yeah, it's 22:13-19. So if the, when the accusation is disproven, the husband is to be fined and is no longer to have the right of divorcing the wife.
Oh, wow.
So it's interesting that then this kind of magical inscription doesn't have any of the kind of Deuteronomic code protections kind of that are there, you know, flimsy at best and scant at best for women. But Numbers lets the guy, you can be as jealous as you want to. You can assume you're...
Yeah, and maybe as often as you want to.
Like, yeah.
Is this a monthly ordeal?
Yeah, or, you know, it's twice a year
kind
of a thing. But yeah, so he has a real ramifications in Deuteronomy. If he's suspicious and accuses and it turns out to be false, but in Numbers, he gets away with it. So, men.
What a turd.
Men.
So, well, that's been the interesting little SOTAR ritual. We hope that you enjoyed. Again, you can listen to us currently on SoundCloud or on the Stitcher app. Hopefully we'll be on iTunes this week.
Soon. Well, hopefully soon.
Follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, rate, review, subscribe, helps share with your friends. And if you have any topics that you'd be interested in us talking about, feel free to email us at, about giving you my personal email address, notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com, all one word. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Just be nice to us. You can disagree with us. But you have to be nice.
We have feelings.
We have feelings, and I ain't putting up with it. So, anyway, bye.
See ya.